So tonight, I'd like to offer a short recap talk from last week's exploration of the transcendental dependent origination. So this is one of the maps the Buddha created and discovered for awakening, going from suffering all the way through liberation. Now, we just spent the year looking at dependent origination, which is a map of how and why we suffer. How we create this cycle of endless suffering. How suffering begins with ignorance, goes into this whole process of making craving and birthing and death and more suffering. So it becomes this endless loop that just cycles over and over. While the transcendental dependent origination is a one-way direction, it goes one direction and then that's it, toward liberation. So it's very different. So it's not an exact one-for-one ratio with dependent origination. It's a different loop. But they both start in the similar place, which is, I think, is very, very interesting and very meaningful. Because dependent origination ends with suffering, then goes through all the birthing and then finally to death and then suffering again becomes what starts the next cycle of ignorance. While transcendental dependent origination begins with suffering and instead leads to faith, leads to freedom. So how does this work? This is really the key issue I see here. I'd like to explore tonight is our relationship to suffering. And does it lead toward our ignorance, toward more suffering, or does it start to lead toward freedom, to awakening? This is the fundamental question that we hold and explore. The Buddha was very famous for saying that he taught only one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. And so dependent origination and this transcendental dependent origination are two expressions of how we suffer and how we release that suffering. So this key issue of suffering and where does it lead toward ignorance or toward faith? So suffering, to step back for a second and realize it's not the fact that we will never experience pain, that we'll never experience discomfort in our bodies, in our minds, in our hearts, you know, through the bruises and bumps of the world, the assaults we experience. Those all cause a certain level of suffering. The loss of loved ones is a level of suffering. And so the suffering that the Buddha was really looking at is what we add to that basic human ratio or ration, I should say, of suffering is what we add to it, how we amplify and make that suffering more intense. And the basic underlying process is that we link it back to the sense of me. We make it personal. And in that personalness of it, that amplifies the suffering. So ignorance and suffering are very linked. So ignorance is often depicted as someone who's lost, is blind, has no sight. And it's a metaphor for not being able to see how things actually are. This basic confusion of how the world is constructed and deconstructed. So particularly suffering and ignorance has the sense of blindness around these three characteristics of dukkha, of impermanence, and of non-self. So we take something that we think is inherently satisfying, that's pleasant, that's enjoyable, a pleasant thought. And we mistake it as being lasting, as being inherently sufficient, inherently substantial. And yet that momentary experience, that momentary thought, even if it lasts for a period of time, eventually fades, eventually ends. So this is the first characteristic as of dukkha, of this inherent unsubstantiality of life, of experience, and how we try to find a lasting happiness and stability in that, that will be suffering from that. This is very related to the second characteristic of impermanence, that life is constantly in flux, constantly arising and passing away in small scales and big scales. And the confusion is when we take something as being permanent, being stable, being substantial, and yet it's impermanent. And then the final one is anatta, is non-self. That we take this role of I adopt in my life, or even the deep sense of identity, the sense of me who's having this experience, me who's giving this talk, me who's listening to this, as being unchanging, as being something substantial. And this also is in flux, also is changing. And so not understanding this, that's what maintains this cycle of dependent origination, that we experience this taking birth into a role, into a mind state, an emotion, an opinion, a reaction, a longing. When that fades, it triggers and re-triggers this quality of suffering, which then, because of our underlying ignorance or underlying delusion or underlying blindness, it reinforces the cycle of ignorance. So one of the issues with suffering, I was speaking with someone last week about this, and that suffering is actually a little too comfortable, that it's very familiar. It's something that, even though it's unpleasant, even though it's very painful, it gives us one big benefit. It lets us know who and what we are. It orients us into this body, into this past history, into this projection of the future. It seems paradoxical that something so painful is still has this reward or this benefit. And the main benefit is it orients us. It creates this sense of a solidity. We become known in this. And this is the thing we have to give up as we practice the Buddhist practice, as we practice the Buddhist teachings. And this is the big step, and this is, I think, this very interesting place of dependent origination. It begins and ends with suffering. Right? It's a description of that suffering and how that really defines and creates a sense of me. And so we enter into transcendental dependent origination, which also starts with suffering. But instead of going into ignorance, it goes into faith. It goes into faith. This is such a surprising turn. How does suffering lead into faith? How does that become the first step into transcendental dependent origination? Because sometimes our suffering, it needs to get for us to learn, for us to actually let go of that investment in creating the sense of me. It almost needs to go to the point where it becomes unbearable. More than we can handle, more than we can justify the benefit of being. This is the Buddha's own path, that he lived a very sheltered, luxuriant lifestyle, and yet he started to see people who were aging, who were sick, who were dying and dead. And this shocked him to the core. This suffering that he so feared made him start his journey. Even in our modern time, people like Eckhart Tolle or Byron Katie all began their path or their practice, their deep understanding, their deep awakening was birthed out of suffering, was birthed out of this is not working anymore. And perhaps that's what brought us to our practice, each one of us, in some way. May not, sometimes there's different gates that bring us into practice. But often we just get tired of how the mind continues to create suffering. Or we try to find some way to deal with these intensely difficult situations in our lives. There must be some way to find that path through, that path to happiness that's outside of my conditions, outside of the circumstances. And when we enter the path in this way, we're entering the same way that the Buddha did. The same way that transcendental dependent origination begins with that quality of faith. Suffering leads to that faith. And that faith, the way I define it, is this willingness or this trust, really, this trust and this belief in something that's beyond what I know. Okay, what I know is this whole field of suffering, how my mind and myself is really integrated to it. I'm the one who's having this thought, this worry, this emotion, this experience. And that's what's known. Faith is that willingness to go beyond what's known, really a trust in something that's beyond what I can see, what I understand. It may take the form of the trust in the practice. It's something about how it's presented, how it's talked about. It elicits that quality of faith, that turning away from suffering, increasing ignorance, suffering then starts to lead us toward faith. Trust in the refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. It's faith starts to give us this courage to start abandoning this comfort of suffering, this comfort of suffering and how suffering orients us. It defines us. It creates a sense of who I am. And for most people, if we're honest, that's the most important thing, is to actually be who we are. You know, that urge to be oriented, to have that identity, even if it's a painful identity. The paradox of practice, though, is that that keeps us away from our true identity, the true nature of who we really are. That's not held or defined by any self-belief, any idea, any label that someone else puts on us. This is what we discover as we practice. So faith, from suffering to faith, there starts to become this quality of joy. This is the third link in this transcendental dependent origination. There's this hope, this is really the heart is starting to realize there is a way through. Seeing through all the conditions, all the circumstances, that's secondary to my relationship to them. That there is actually a path I can walk. There's a path I can explore and see through my own suffering, to see through my ignorance. And this joy then in the transcendental dependent origination starts to unfold toward developing and cultivation of concentration. So concentration is this capacity for the mind to stay very steady, to not have this wavering, distracted tendency that we usually have, but it's steadiness. And the steadiness is so helpful to be able to start to pierce through our ignorance, through our delusion, through our blindness. And so it goes through some classical steps toward that of rapture, of this energy unfolding and kind of uncorking in our bodies, the tranquility as that starts to find a balance, the happiness as that becomes more integrated, and finally samadhi or concentration. So concentration, as I spoke of last week, has its kind of a little bit of a siren, if you use Ulysses' metaphor, that it's so pleasant. It draws us toward the pleasant states because there's a shelterness, there's a deep calm, there's a deep peace and ease in the midst of that. But yet that is also conditioned. It's also impermanent. We've actually kind of sequestered and absorbed our minds in one area of awareness. And the Buddha is very clear that this, although it's very helpful, it's also dukkha. Those states of jhana are also dukkha, are also impermanent. And so for the point of concentration is to allow us to see clearly, to see through this veil of delusion, like the sun breaking through the fog and a morning. And this is really the key piece here in dependent originate, or this transcendental dependent arising, is to actually see things how they actually are. To actually see very clearly the nature of things. In particular, the three characteristics. To actually see dukkha as dukkha. To see what's unsubstantial as being unsubstantial. To see what's impermanent as impermanent, and to see what's inherently empty of self as empty of self. Now, from as I see these, you know, from our normal perspective, that sounds like a pretty downer thing to try to do. But it's actually, there's this joy that comes forth when you start to see this, because you're not living life through the filter of your thoughts, through your prejudice, through your preconceptions. You're living life directly how it's unfolding. So there's no separation. So transcendental dependent origination uses concentration as one of these ways of piercing through this delusion. Insight practice, inquiry, are other ways. And there's other processes, maybe devotion. And this is when we have whatever leads to a clear seeing, whatever allows us to start to see through the power of our delusion. It may simply be a very deep, burning interest to see how life actually is, a deep curiosity that takes wherever it takes us, even to the unraveling of the foundation of my self-belief and my belief in how the world's shaped, to actually see through that. You know, it's asked quite a bit, but if the passion and interest is there, it can see through that, see through the very underpinnings of our world and ourselves. So seeing things how they actually are. So dependent origination is really designed for us not to see, is actually designed to teach us, or for us not to see, it describes, I should say, how we actually see, don't see how things actually are. How it's really created, this is a beautifully described process, how we create ignorance. And that's why we don't see how things are. It's really started by and fueled by our ignorance, by our blindness. And this is a literal creating of the world that we perceive. We look out in the world and we not see how it actually is. We see through our prejudices, through our bias, through our conditioning. This is the name and form, this shape of consciousness, that what sense gates we actually pay attention to and what aspects we pay attention to. Even though what we perceive as being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, these are all deeply conditioned by ignorance. So dependent origination is fueled by ignorance, and it reinforces ignorance, driven and shaped by ignorance. While transcendental dependent arising is instead driven and shaped by wisdom. And the wisdom is that very first link, that movement, okay, I'm not going to buy into this suffering. That suffering is not going to reinforce my ignorance. It starts to reinforce my wisdom. That suffering starts to teach me how things actually are. And so transcendental dependent arising leads toward freedom because it's driven and shaped by wisdom. And then from there, it goes into disenchantment, dispassion, emancipation, and knowledge and destruction of the cantors, of our basic core delusion. And perhaps next week we'll explore this second part of it. But once we get to see how things, how they actually are, when that starts to really open up in us, whether we have the gateway of concentration or insight or just a burning desire to see how things actually are, it just starts to lead from one link to another. We start to move through our lives based on wisdom instead of our ignorance. All right, so let's sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle. Ask some questions, or you can raise your hand. Probably blue hand, virtual hands better than the real hand because they may not see it. All right, let's go ahead and unmute yourself.
Thank you. In our group, one of the things that we started to talk about was the process of getting close to the distress or nonsense that's going on that we get involved with and that we use to build our egos. And I have a tendency to, as soon as I recognize something like that's happening, my tendency is, unless it's something useful that I need to pay attention to in the relative world, I stand back from that pretty, you know, as fast as I can. But I may be missing something in standing back rather than really being more involved with what the distress or the nonsense is about. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes, I think that's a good reflection, because as meditators, we're developing this capacity to be present, to meet the moment's experience, but also we are learning how to like disengage from, you know, our normal reactivity. And sometimes that can often feel like a refuge, a place of kind of not being lost or normal suffering patterns, which is better than being lost. But yet we start to find that it's a habit that we just naturally turn away from, you know, and so it's like a subtle kind of turning away from that experience. And so I think it's often helpful, especially with something that's repetitive, to try not to do anything with it other than simply observe it. And so that actually often means going a little bit more into the stew of that reactivity, the stew of that suffering, to actually see how, you know, what does that actually feel like? It may sound intellectual, but I'm really suggesting a very embodied approach, you know, feeling the tightness in the chest or the tension, feeling that, you know, what does the emotion actually feel like as a body experience? And then from that point saying, okay, what's the belief system that I'm holding? What am I believing? What am I thinking is true? These are all ways to start to uncover that unconscious construction around that suffering. And if we just kind of, you know, turn away from it, you know, as we know how to do as meditators, we miss that. And then it comes back again, because that kind of maintains that ignorance, because there's that bit of turning away from it. You know, and so that's especially helpful for some of these deeper patterns that we have personally and also as a society. You know, the willingness to turn into, to look at some of those very difficult, painful habits of mind, you know, like prejudice, like racism, for example, to really challenge those and start to open them up and eventually see the emptiness in them. And then that translates into how we act in the world. And sometimes just turning away, you know, it can become a easy way of avoiding if we're not careful. So the fact that you asked that question, it sounds like there may be a little bit of that. Am I turning away to avoid or to find that place of stability? You know, certainly sometimes we need to find some stability because it's so overwhelming what we're going through, and that's what's needed. But particularly the habitual ones that come again and again, the frequent visitors, it's helpful to start to bring some investigation toward them.
So would it be fair to say that what you're suggesting is that by staying with dukkha and being an observer is helpful in ending that cycle of reappearing and reappearing and reappearing?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, because that dukkha has a level of blindness to it, of ignorance to it that we're just not seeing. And so you turn toward it, you observe it. It's almost like you want to observe it and allow it to kind of cycle in kind of an empty way without you becoming so invested in it. But you're observing the process of it cycling, the process of like, oh, wow, I'm really believing in this, or this is what it means about me or means about someone else. And by holding it and seeing it this way, we're already starting to loosen that personalization around it, the identification around it. And that is starting to really loosen the cycle of dependent origination.
That is extremely helpful. Thank you, Tim.
You're very welcome. All right, what else is out there? And again, if you're waving your actual hand, I may not see it. So you can just unmute yourself, or you can go and by participants, raise your hand. All right, Steve, go ahead.
Hi there, and thank you very much. One thing we talked, Frank, as I talked about in the small group, and I wondered if you could, what your thoughts are, is just the distinction between pain and suffering. And, you know, like, to me, those two words, that they aren't the same, is, like, in a lot of ways, right, kind of on the edge of my practice a lot of the time, and just, you know, pain happens, all kinds of difficult emotional, physical pains happen, but being able to kind of in the middle of it, see where the three characteristics helps you see that it's not actually suffering, it's just pain, and to be able to kind of ride with it, it's just been like so helpful. And so I almost feel like discerning between those two words drives seeing. And I wonder if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I like that distinction. You know, it's a very simple and concrete description because, you know, pain is not optional. You know, we're going to experience right. physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain. But the suffering, that is optional, you know, how we add to that. And, you know, where that line is, sometimes it gets really blurry. And sometimes we don't notice it until we actually step back or it's relieved that, oh, I was really adding a lot of additional suffering. And, you know, this is vividly described, as you know, in the second Dart Sutta, where we have the first Dart. Everybody's going to feel that, from the Buddha down to the untaught person. The suffering is the second Dart, the added reactivity. And so there's certainly different levels of reactivity. We can look at it from a physical standpoint. There can be a physical pain, and we could practice relaxing with it and it's trying to open to it, you know, trying to have as little resistance is another way of saying that. Suffering and resistance are often very connected. And yet, you know, we can, if we're not carefully looking at how the whole cluster of suffering emerges, I might be trying to relax physically with the pain, but I'm adding a lot of mental suffering to it. Like if I'm a good meditator, I'm going to just power through this knee pain, or I'm going to suffer through these 2 hour sits or something like that. It's something I impose upon the experience. And so it's often that's a way of looking at it. What do I add? What am I adding to this moment? That's where the suffering is going to lie. It could be, you know, self-belief. It could be how I think I should be. It could also be just that really that subtle sense of me who's having this experience, claiming ownership in some way is often the big piece of what makes something suffering versus just experiencing pain. But I think that's a lovely reflection, Steve, is to hold that, is to say, what is pain here? What's this unavoidable pain? And what's been added to it? What's the suffering aspect of it?
Yeah. I mean, I'll just say one more thing relative to the Buddha's life, because this always strikes me. I mean, his life was gnarly in a lot of ways because, you know, his cousin's trying to kill him. One of his best friends, in a sense, King Bimbisara, was killed by his son basically in front of his eyes. And then, you know, a bunch of monks misunderstood the way he talked about not getting hung up in their bodies and committed suicide. You know, so it just seemed like on a very, you know, sort of human level, lots of pain happened that he had to actually not have it be suffering. So it's really pretty extraordinary. It's kind of humbling. Not for me. Thank you.
Yeah. I think it's for myself, and it sounds like for you too, it's helpful to see the Buddha as a human being with human mm-hmm. bodies, the human body, human mind, human, you know, emotions. And he would experience the same suffering that we would. It just, or same pain we would. It's that added element to it.
Thank
All right,
you.
Thank you, Steve. All right, anyone else out there? How was the group discussion? Anything that was surprising or insightful or not so helpful? Whatever came up.
This is Emery.
Hi, Emery. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Visiting us from Portland. Nice to see you.
Yeah, it's such a special treat to be able to be there. So thank you. And I'm really curious about the idea of faith that you were talking about in your talk and the trust that's required. because I definitely feel like there are times when I touch into that disillusion of self and the sense of this big holding space of everything, and that it's my own brain holding what's happening is no different than the bigger holding. But then I start to feel very disoriented and very, like it's hard for me to stay very long because I don't feel like I can trust it and like I won't be able to really function in the real world and cook dinner and make a grocery list. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
Yeah, you know, I think you described it very well, is that there's that faith that, you know, that when we have that sense of the self-thinning and becoming less strong, less identified with, there is that, you know, on one hand, there's that opening to something much vaster. And, you know, I like how you said it's that sense of holding, something is holding that's similar to how I hold something as my own mind, but it's so much bigger, so much larger. And it's like we're opening that sense of self suddenly is joining something that's much vaster. And from that place, you know, it is disorienting. It is maybe disconcerting because so much of the way we move through our lives has this underpinning, this premise that I'm doing it, that I'm getting engaged. I have to cook dinner. I have to do my job. I have to deal with my kids. All of those different things, it filters through that sense of me. In some ways, the stronger that sense of you is in some arenas, the more effective you are. You know, I have this opinion. I'm the boss. I'm the expert here. I'm, you know, whatever it might be. It really reinforces itself. And so it's almost like this paradox of how do I go through life if I see through the illusion of self and if I really open deeply to that, you know, and there's that disorientation that's kind of it's kind of in a halfway, you have halfway between one place and another. How do I live this life? How do I do what needs to be done? And it's one of those interesting koans that it's like from the sense of self's perspective, it seems impossible. Like there's no way I can function. But from the, let's say the ultimate or the absolute or that non-self perspective, it makes sense. You know, there's a way that the sense of self becomes something that you pick up when it's needed. It's like a hat you put on. I think I've used this analogy sometimes in my taught retreats that, let's say I was a firefighter and I put on all my bunker gear when I had to go into a burning building. That's very appropriate. That's that sense of self you pick on that role. But if I take that same bunker gear, all the heavy equipment, and I try to go to a restaurant or I, you know, go out and, you know, jog in the woods or something, it doesn't serve me. And so you start to see that sense of self is really just a tool that we pick up when it's appropriate, when it's needed, but we see it as inherently empty. And that doesn't make any sense from the sense of self and that basic fundamental ignorance and delusion is that there's only the sense of self. That's the only thing that we see. And kind of the big joke is once we see through that, we realize, oh, there's this much vaster reality, this much vaster perspective that's always present. And the fact that I put on a role to be a father or to be a husband or to be a teacher doesn't negate that. In fact, it enhances that role because I'm much more fluid in it. A lot of our, like Steve was talking about that suffering, a lot of the suffering is when we really believe in that role, and that sense of self, when we're not yielding with it, when we get tight around it, when someone threatens us, when we tell our child, okay, it's time to go to sleep, and they just ignore us. Or like with my daughter, okay, you've been on the screen a little 8 hours today, I think it's time to put it down. You know, there's that edge. Right? That's the role being believed in. Right? And if I know, okay, that's just a role and I'm just rubbing against another, butting hands against another self, then I'm caught in the suffering. But if I realize, okay, this is just a role I've picked up, and maybe I easily let go of that and go into a different role. So it's that fluidity. And it is that there's this place of kind of disorientation and, you know, kind of, things are just dissolving that we're not quite sure, you know, how do I operate in this world? So a lot of it is learning to, I think that's where faith, your question comes around, is that faith and that trust that, okay, if I surrender, things won't fall apart, that there still be me to stand up if I need to do something, to say what needs to be said or to do what needs to be done. And the faith, though, is trusting that. Is from the isolated sense of self, it is a complete leap of faith. Because in some ways, it's the ultimate leap. Because in a way that we have, our sense of self has a death that happens. There's a way that that falls away. And that's scary until we go through it enough times. All right. Hopefully that helps, Emery. All right, thank you. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much.
All right, anyone else like to share anything or ask anything?
So can I look at being able to pick up self as a tool rather than identifying it with it, using it as a tool while in a state of larger awareness sounds like a really nuanced skill.
Well, it's less of a skill and more of a perspective or an understanding. Because if you see, you know, when you really have a glimpse into the emptiness of self, then it just doesn't make sense to believe in self in the same way. But then yet you realize, okay, this sense of self does help me get the job done. It helps me navigate the world. So it kind of gets reoriented. Instead of being the fundamental assumption of how I go through the world, it's just a role that I pick up. And it's actually, I think this, as what I was talking with Emery about, is that sense of switching roles, it's almost like a sense of self that you pick up. So whatever kind of job you have or whatever kind of roles that you have in your life, there's some places that people recognize that role and respond to you and relate to you from that role. But you can go to a totally different place where people don't know who you are or what you do or what your expertise are. They don't relate to you in the same way. And if you go and say, you know, I'm actually an expert in this field, you should pay attention to me, you're kind of caught in that role. But if instead you say, okay, what's being asked of me right now in this new relationship, this, you know, someone who's, you know, let's say in a grocery store or being out in nature that's a really lovely way to kind of go back and forth. You step into your role, you do what needs to be done, and then you look at nature and how nature doesn't care whatever role you are. Whether you're a president or a mail clerk, you know, whatever it might be, it has no bearing. You know, and nature, I think, is a great teacher of that, a much broader, more vast emptiness. And so then it's really, I think, a nice way to practice with, to see how fluid can I be? And you start to find that you're actually much more, life is more fluid because you're able to be much more spontaneous. And those places where there's that gritch and rub, if you look, you can see, oh, that's where I'm identified. That's where I'm claiming I, me, and mine. Thank you, Leslie. All right, maybe room for one or two more.
Hi.
Hello.
This is my first time, or actually second time, I think, or maybe first time. I don't know. Anyway, so I was talking about this in our breakout room and how much of the meditation I've done maybe in the last 8 months, sort of had this incredible opening to things, to where the trees in my backyard just started moving towards me, you know, mm-hmm. just really incredibly powerful connectedness and complete loss of anything, and all the thoughts were gone. It was just so amazing. And anyway, I'm going through some other stuff now, and I've been meditating, and I'm losing faith, like completely mm-hmm. in, it's like I can't get back in touch with that, and my mind won't stop. And I know this seems, you know, I know the grasping situation, non-resistance and all of that, mm-hmm. and just maybe having faith that things will come back. I mean, I'm not trying to look for a high. I'm just trying to, yeah. you know, kind of become centered again. And I'm so not. So I don't know if you could speak to that.
Sure. Yeah, Anthony, thank you for sharing that, and welcome to, whether it's your first or second or how many times.
Right.
So yeah, those moments when we have that, you know, that sense of like the trees getting closer to you, it's like that sense of separation is falling away, you know, and that's, you're seeing through this, one of the basic delusions or ignorance that there is separation. And in that place, there's this deep, profound sense of interconnection. And it feels very profound. It feels very magical. It feels in some ways the most alive that you've ever felt, because you're in the midst of that. And so this is one of the pitfall, or I don't say pitfalls, but one of the things that happens as meditators is, you know, you name some of the typical things, like, I want to get back to that state, but it sounds like you're realizing that, so you're not lost in the craving of it. And yet it seems so far away. You know, it's kind of like the dog trying to catch the tail. The faster you go, the further the tail goes. And also just I think in a helpful perspective, and you can see that after a big opening like that, when you see something, you know, there's this deep experience of interconnection, or even after just a quiet sit. I remember how just noticing when I was, especially early in my practice, I might have a still sit, and then I would want to kind of re-engage myself. Like I find myself opening the refrigerator, or, you know, watching a movie, because I get a little disoriented, and that's that hunger to want to, okay, let's put myself back together. Let me have a fight with somebody, or let's get, you know, caught in craving. And that's that, that's giving me a glimpse of that underlying tanha, that thirst to become, that thirst to be. So sometimes it's not necessarily a bad sign that you can't find that access point, because that's just kind of like a wave of that coming through your system. So what you do, the way to practice with that, at least one way, it's just to say, okay, what's here right now? Okay, what's here right now? And that question itself is already starting to loosen that resistance to this moment, mm. right? And so, because those kind of experiences, it's like, where, how does it inform this very moment is where the power of it is. And that, mm. and so there's a level of resistance that you're having. Okay, this moment's not how I want the moment to be. Okay, mm-hmm. So let me get to know what that resistance actually feels like. What's its shape? What's its physical, mental, emotional components of it? And just that willingness to get to know it, you're already starting to have non-resistance to it. Mm. And then it starts to, you know, sometimes it just takes a while for that well of resistance to fall through. And then suddenly the trees is like, oh, it's always been here. How could I not see it? And that's like that blindness coming through us and then opening through. And so that's where the faith and the patience of practice really serves us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony. Thanks for your question. All right. If there's one last question, otherwise we can say goodnight.
Jim?
Yes.
It's Susan. Hi. I'm just captivated with faith now, and seeing it as perhaps like a navigation or a magnetic north that I can come back to, and it's like a remembering that this is you know, a real path that you know, it keeps pointing me to, you know, magnetic north. It keeps pointing me to the direction of the path, and that, you know, I just have to suspend my disbelief and, you know, get grounded, a felt sense of the body, and experience that this is true for me. You know, there are many others, you know, in my life that are not on the same, not using the same, you know, sure, navigation, but I'm kind of looking at it with that word. Does that feel?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's
real to you.
Yes. Yeah. That sense of faith and that orienteering of like true north, you know, like when we, you know, we know what is deeply true. And sometimes it's like we may lose access, as Anthony was said, like we may have lose access to that connection. But we also have, we know faith comes up, we may not be able to see which way north is, but we know what's not north. You know, so that's where the faith comes in. Like, well, I don't know which direction to go, but at least I know not to go south. At least I know not to go east or west. And so you start to, you're just like, okay, I'm going to use those experiences as a way that you're trusting that that is the right direction and that will reveal itself.
But after a while, it seems to take on a life, a power of its own. That's what right. I'm intuiting.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's some, that's like going back to Emery's question, is that when something else starts to move through our lives, when it's not so much always me having to do this or that, it's something else is trying to move us through. And that's like that, we could say the background stillness, the background emptiness. It's like there's a resonance with our hearts that's trying to resonate in that direction. And it is just like the magnetic north and the compass, that little piece of polarized metal is pointing toward the polarity of the earth. And it's like our heart is starting to orient that way. Yeah, I think that's a lovely way to hold it, Susan. All right, thank you. All right, thank you all for your engaged questions and engagement with this important exploration.